It's none of their business. How dare they knock on our door uninvited? No courtesy. They have no right to make us feel like this. We stay very quiet and very still until they go away. Some people knock in a loud, angry, accusing way, as if they know they are being tricked and they're angry about it. But eventually they give up and go away. Sure enough, the knocking got louder and angrier. Her mother's eyes burned with hatred. They have no right, no right. Erica shook herself. There was no one knocking on her front door. She was at a barbecue. Where were the little girls? She saw a flash of blue in the corner of the yard. Holly sat cross-legged on the grass with her bag, carefully taking out her rocks and laying them down in a row, one by one. She liked to catalogue her collection at intervals. There was a burst of laughter from the table. Still that knocking sound. Where was it coming from? Erica looked at the ridiculous fountain. She could see rubbish floating in the fountain. Someone's old coat spinning in a slow circle. Her mother had piles and piles of coats, big winter coats, as if they lived in Siberia, not Sydney. Well, she wasn't going to pull that coat out of the fountain. It was not her responsibility. She'd had enough of cleaning up. Knock, knock, knock. How dare you knock on our door in that entitled way? It was coming from somewhere above her. She looked up, and there was Harry, grumpy old Harry, standing at his upstairs window as though he were pressed against it, not knocking, but banging on the glass, like he was trying to escape. He saw her looking. He pointed. He jabbed his finger violently in the direction of the fountain. His mouth gaped in a silent shout. She could tell from the stance of his body and his gestures that he was angry with her. He was yelling something at her. He wanted her to clean up that rubbish. The neighbors were always angry. They always wanted her to clean up the rubbish. She wouldn't. It was not her responsibility. She stared at the fountain, at the old pink coat turning in slow circles. She saw Whisk lying on the side of the fountain. That wasn't an old coat. That wasn't rubbish. The adrenaline was like a shot to her heart. All the things she'd stolen from Clementine, but she'd never meant to do this. Her fault. Her fault. Her fault. The plates fell from her hands. She screamed Clementine's name. Chapter 79. The first aid course was held at the local high school, which their girls would presumably one day attend, although the thought of a time when they were old enough to go to high school felt like science fiction. Their teacher was a large, cheerful, mildly condescending woman called Jan, who reminded Clementine of an insufferable flautist she used to see each year at music camp. Jan began the day by going around the room and asking everyone to say their name and reason for being there, and, as a fun little icebreaker exercise, to answer the question, "If you were a vegetable, what vegetable would you be?" They started with a muscly young personal trainer called Dale, who was there because he needed first aid training for his PT license, and who would be a baby kale, if given the choice, because it was a powerhouse vegetable. At this point, he flexed an impressive biceps, and he had a baby face. "Excellent answer," said Jan, looking momentarily overcome by Dale's biceps, which made Clementine feel fondly toward her. Next was a squat, middle-aged woman who was there because there had been a fatal accident at the office where she worked. A tradesman got electrocuted, and the woman had never felt so useless or helpless in her life, and she didn't want to ever feel that way again, even though she didn't believe it would have made a difference to the poor tradesman. "If I was a vegetable, I'd be a potato," said the woman. "Obviously." And she indicated her body, and everyone laughed loudly and then stopped abruptly, in case they weren't meant to laugh. Sam was next, and he spoke up confidently and clearly, sitting casually back in his chair, his legs stretched out in front of him. He said that he and his wife, he indicated Clementine, were doing the course because they had small children. Clementine looked at him. She would have told the truth. She would have said that their daughter had nearly drowned. She was always ready to share the story, but even when they were with Ruby at the hospital, Sam had avoided telling people why they were there, as if it was a deeply shameful secret. "I'd be an onion," said Sam, "because I'm very complex. I have layers." That got a good laugh too, and Clementine realized that Sam did this sort of thing all the time. Training workshops, team building days. This was his jokey, blokey, corporate persona. He probably always chose the onion. When it was her turn, she didn't bother saying why she was there, as Sam had covered it. She said that she'd be a tomato, because it went so well with onion. And Sam smiled, but warily, as if she were a stranger trying to come on to him. And she was reminded of the humiliation of waking up that morning and talking to him when he wasn't there. "Aw," said everyone, except for the person behind Clementine, who said, "A tomato is a fruit." "It's a vegetable today," said Jan crisply. And Clementine decided she was nothing like the flautist. Once they'd gone around the class, Jan said that if she were a vegetable, she'd be an avocado, because she took a while to soften up. "An avocado is a fruit," sighed the fruit expert behind Clementine. And she was there today because first aid was her passion, which made Clementine feel teary. How wonderful it was that there were people in the world like Jan with a passion for helping strangers. Then they got down to business, and Clementine and Sam both diligently took notes as Jan took them through the basic life support procedure, interspersed with stories from Jan's own first aid experience, like the time she'd run a course and found herself in the middle of a real-life scenario when one of the participants collapsed in class. "Did you use it as a demonstration?" asked someone. "No, I had to clear the room," said Jan. "People started dropping like flies. Down they went like dominoes. Bang, bang, bang." She said this with relish, to indicate the weakness of the general population. "That's why you've got to give everyone a job. Go call the ambulance, get me some ice, or send them away, because otherwise people go into shock. It's a traumatic event. You can suffer from post-traumatic stress. We'll talk about that later." Clementine glanced over at Sam to see if he was remembering their own traumatic event, but his face was impassive. He wrote something down in his notepad. Jan got Dale, the muscly personal trainer, to lie on the floor and then picked two attractive young girls, Carrot and Cauliflower, to have a go at putting Dale into the recovery position, which they did. And because they were three attractive young people, it was kind of enjoyable to watch. And when they rolled Dale over, you could see his underwear riding up under his shorts, and Jan said, "Nice to see you wearing Calvin Klein today." It was all good fun. It was interesting and informative, and Sam asked intelligent questions and made the occasional well-timed joke. That's why it was so unexpected when it happened. Clementine had to breathe hard when Jan demonstrated CPR on a bright blue plastic dummy of a head and torso. The rocking motion of Jan's hands, pushing so forcefully and rapidly, brought it all back, the hard pavers beneath her knees, Ruby's waxen cheeks and blue lips, the fairy lights winking in her peripheral vision. But she breathed through it, and when she looked at Sam, he seemed fine. Then Jan asked everyone to get into pairs, and she gave each pair one blue dummy and two disposable resuscitation face shields. Jan always had a spare disposable face shield on her keyring. That's how prepared she was to offer her services. They had to find a free spot on the floor where they could lay the dummy out flat. Jan wandered around the room, checking on everyone's progress. "Do you want to go first?" said Clementine to Sam. They were both on their knees, on either side of the dummy. "Sure," said Sam. And he seemed fine as he methodically worked his way through the acronym Jan had just taught them. DRS ABCD, standing for Danger Response, Send for Help, Airway Breathing, CPR, and Defibrillator. He cleared the airway. He looked, listened, and felt for breathing. He commenced CPR, his locked hands pressing rhythmically on the dummy's chest. And as he did, his eyes met Clementine's, and she saw a bead of sweat roll down the side of his face. "Sam? Are you all right?" said Clementine. He shook his head, a tiny no, but he didn't stop doing CPR compressions. His face was dead white. His eyes were bloodshot. She didn't know what to do. "Are you having chest pains?" At least they were in the right place. Jan seemed just as competent as any doctor or paramedic, and certainly more passionate. He shook his head again. He bent his head, pinched the dummy's nostrils, and gave it two breaths. The dummy's chest rose to show that he'd done it correctly. He lifted his head and recommenced compressions, and Clementine saw, with a kick in the stomach sense of shock, that tears were sliding down his face and dripping onto the dummy. She'd never seen her husband cry, properly cry, not on their wedding day, not when the children were born, not when Ruby was not breathing, not when she woke up the next day. And she'd never questioned it, because she'd never seen her father cry either, and her older brothers weren't criers, they were door slammers and wall hitters during their angry young man years. Her mother got teary at times, but Clementine was the family's only true crier. She was always in floods of tears over something. Maybe all those staunch, stoic men around her had resulted in her internalizing that ancient cliche, "Boys don't cry." Because it was absolutely astonishing to Clementine that Sam could cry like that, that his body was even capable of doing that, of producing that many tears. As she watched his tears drip onto the dummy, she felt something break inside her, and a great welling of sympathy rise within her chest, and the terrible thought occurred to her that perhaps she'd always unconsciously believed that because Sam didn't cry, he therefore didn't feel, or he felt less, not as profoundly and deeply as she did. Her focus had always been on how his actions affected her feelings, as if his role was to do things for her, to her, and all that mattered was her emotional response to him, as if a man were a product or a service, and she'd finally chosen the right brand to get the right response. Was it possible she'd never seen or truly loved him the way he deserved to be seen and loved? As a person, an ordinary, flawed, feeling person. "Oh, Sam!" He stood up so fast from his kneeling position that he nearly toppled backwards. He averted his face, rubbing his cheek hard with the heel of one hand as if something had stung him. He turned and left the room. Chapter 80. "Sorry," said Clementine to the teacher, "I'll just go and check on my husband. I think he's not feeling well." "Of course," said Jan. She added hopefully, "Let me know if you need me." Clementine left the classroom and looked to the left. He was already nearly at the far end of the corridor. "Sam!" she called, half running past classrooms filled with adults bettering themselves. He seemed to pick up his pace. "Sam!" she called again. "Wait!" She followed him to a quiet, deserted passageway with a glass ceiling that connected two buildings. The walls were jammed with grey lockers. Sam suddenly stopped. He found a narrow column of space in between two blocks of lockers, the sort of hidey hole the girls would gravitate toward, and he sat down, his back against the wall. He rested his forehead on his knees. His shoulders heaved silently. There was a round patch of sweat on his shirt. She went to touch his shoulder, but her hand hovered uncertainly for a few seconds before she changed her mind. Instead, she sat down opposite him, on the other side of the passageway, her back against the cool metal of a locker. There were squares of sunlight all the way along the corridor, like a train of sunshine. She felt strangely peaceful as she waited for Sam to stop crying, breathing in the nostalgic fragrance of high school. At last Sam looked up, his face wet and puffy. "Sorry," he said. "Well, that was dignified." "Are you all right?" she said. "It was the compressions," said Sam. He ran the back of his hand across his nose and sniffed. "I know," said Clementine. "It felt like I was there." He used his palms to rub his cheekbones in a circular motion. "I know," she said again. He looked up at the ceiling and did something with his tongue, as if he were trying to get food out of his teeth. The sunlight shone on the wall behind him and made his eyes look very blue in the shadowiness of his face. He looked simultaneously very young and very old, as if all the past and future versions of himself were overlaid on his face. "I always had this idea in my head that I was good in a crisis," said Sam. "You are good in a crisis. I thought if I was ever tested, if there was a fire or a gunman or a zombie apocalypse, I'd take care of my family. I'd be the man." He made his voice deep and contemptuous on the word man. "Sam, it wasn't just that I took my eyes off Ruby. It wasn't just that I was trying to open a jar of nuts to impress a bloody stripper, of all things, while my little girl drowned right next to me." He took a deep, shaky breath. "But I didn't move. I watched another man drag my little girl from that god-awful fountain, and I just stood there, like a stunned mullet." "You did move," said Clementine. "It's just that they got there first, and they knew what they were doing. It was only a split second. It just feels like longer. And then you did move. I promise you, you did." Sam lifted his shoulders. An expression of complete self-loathing crossed his face. "Anyway, I can't change what I did or didn't do. I've just got to stop thinking about it. I've got to get it out of my head. I keep replaying it over and over and over. It's stupid, pointless. I can't work and I can't sleep and I'm taking it out on you and I just need to pull myself together." "Maybe," said Clementine tentatively, "you could, or we could, talk to someone. Like a professional sort of person. Like a shrink, said Sam with a strained smile. Because I'm losing my mind. Like a shrink, said Clementine. Because it sounds like you are losing your mind. Just a little bit. I was thinking when the teacher mentioned post-traumatic stress earlier. Sam looked appalled. Post-traumatic stress, he said, like a war veteran. Except I didn't come back from Iraq or Afghanistan where I saw people get blown up. No, I've just come back from a backyard barbecue. Where you saw your daughter nearly drown, said Clementine. Sam closed his eyes. Your daughter nearly drowned, said Clementine again. And you feel responsible. Sam raised his eyes to the ceiling and exhaled. I don't have post-traumatic stress syndrome, Clementine. Jesus, that's humiliating. That's pathetic. Clementine took her phone out of her jacket pocket. Don't Google, pleaded Sam. Trust me, you're always telling me to stop Googling. It never tells you anything good. I am so Googling, said Clementine, and she felt her breath quicken because she was suddenly seeing all his behaviour ever since the barbecue from a different angle, through a new lens, and she thought of her father saying the other night, he isn't quite right in the head, and how she hadn't listened, not really, not the way you'd listen if somebody had said, your husband is sick. Symptoms of post-traumatic stress syndrome, Clementine read out loud. Replaying of the event over and over. You just said you do that. I'm glad you're so happy about it, said Sam with a ghost of a smile. Sam, you're like a textbook case. Insomnia, yes. Irritability, yes. Solution? Seek treatment. She was speaking facetiously, ironically, kind of idiotically, as if all this were a great joke, as if none of it really mattered, as if her stomach wasn't twisting, as if she didn't feel that this was her only shot, because lately his mood could change in an instant, and in another hour he might refuse to talk about this at all, and he'd be gone again. Look, I don't need to seek treatment, began Sam. Yes, you do, said Clementine, her eyes on the phone. Long-term effects. Divorce, substance abuse. Are you abusing substances? I'm not abusing substances, said Sam. Stop reading that stuff. Put your phone away. Let's go back to class. I really think you need to talk to someone. To a professional someone, said Clementine. She turned into her mother. Next thing she'd be suggesting a lovely psychologist. Will you please talk to someone? Sam tipped his head back and studied the ceiling again. Finally, he looked back at her. I might, he said. Good, said Clementine. She rested her head against the locker and closed her eyes. She felt a sense of inevitability, as if her marriage were a giant ship, and it was too late to change its course now. It was either going to hit the iceberg or not, and nothing she said or did right now would make any difference. If her mother had been observing this interaction, she'd tell Clementine she was wrong, that she needed to keep talking, to say everything that was on her mind, to communicate, to leave no possibility for misinterpretation. If her father were here, he'd put his finger to his lips and say, shh. Clementine settled for two words. I'm sorry, she said. She meant, I'm sorry this happened. I'm sorry I didn't see you were going through this. I'm sorry I maybe haven't loved you the way you deserve to be loved. I'm sorry that when we faced our first crisis, it showed up everything that was wrong in our marriage instead of everything that was right. I'm sorry we turned on each other instead of to each other. Yeah. I'm sorry too, said Sam. Chapter 81. So, in effect, Harry saved Ruby's life, said Oliver. Erica and Oliver were walking around the block near her mother's house. The moment she remembered what had happened, she'd wanted to share it with Oliver, and she certainly didn't want Sylvia to overhear, so she'd insisted Oliver go for a walk with her. Yes, said Erica, and no one ever thanked him. I don't think I even looked up again at his window. They walked by a young husband and wife pushing a baby in a stroller, and Erica shot them a dismissive flick of a smile to let them know there was really no need to comment upon the weather and how great it was that the rain had finally stopped. He would have seen that we got her out, said Oliver. I hope so, said Erica, but no one ever told him that Ruby was okay. No one ever went over and said, thank you. He must have thought that was pretty rude. He always thought everyone had such bad manners, and he would have died thinking that was pretty much conclusive. I guess he could have come over and asked us, said Oliver, if he was worried. They both jumped over a glistening brown puddle that took up most of the footpath. It took me a while to work out that it was Ruby, said Erica. Her mouth felt momentarily full of marbles. I thought it was an old coat floating in the fountain, and I was just staring at it. I had this illogical, weird idea that Harry wanted me to clean up the fountain. Ruby was drowning while I stared right at her. Oliver said nothing for a moment before he spoke. I always felt bad that when it happened I was hiding out in the bathroom, just looking at myself in the mirror, he said. I think we've all got something to feel bad about that afternoon. Except for Harry, said Erica. Except for Harry, agreed Oliver. A middle-aged woman in unflattering active wear came bouncing past. Isn't it lovely to see the sun again? She said rapturously, and she slowed down as if she wanted to discuss the sun further. It's fantastic, agreed Oliver. He and Erica both upping their pace by unspoken agreement. Have a nice day. Do you think I should tell someone, said Erica, about what I remembered? Now that she had the facts straight in her head, she felt an overwhelming desire to set the record straight, to submit an amended report to the authorities. Well, I don't see who you would tell, said Oliver, or how it would help. I could tell Clementine, said Erica, although she had absolutely no intention of doing that. No, said Oliver, you can't tell Clementine. You know you can't. They had completed the block now and were nearing her mother's house. Oh, for goodness sake, sighed Erica. What? Said Oliver. She's actually in the skip bin now. Chapter 82. It had stopped raining. Finally. At last. Dakota could hardly believe it. Everything about her whole life and the whole world felt entirely different. This is going to be so much fun, said Dakota's mum as they opened the front door and stepped outside onto the front veranda. I don't see why we can't drive there, said Dakota's dad for about the millionth time. Why do we have to walk through the streets to get there? Like homeless people. Because we're so lucky to have a beautiful walk less than 10 minutes away from our front door, said her mum. She was holding Barney's leash while Barney jumped about snapping at the air, trying to catch an invisible fly. Her mum was practicing gratitude lately. Her dad said she would get over it soon, hopefully. She had a special jar called a happiness jar. You were meant to write down your happy memories on pieces of paper and then put them in the jar, and then on New Year's Eve you went through the jar and realized all your blessings, or something. It was October, so they had to get their skates on and collect a lot of happy family memories. But we are also lucky to have a Lexus, pointed out her dad. We shouldn't take our Lexus for granted. Her mum had discovered that there was a beautiful bushwalk through a national park in their very own neighbourhood, only a short walk away. This was a very big deal, for some reason. It was like having a window seat. Apparently, Erica and Oliver from next door did this walk all the time, and they were amazed that Dakota's mum didn't even know that it existed, and her mum had felt embarrassed by this, or so she said, although she probably hadn't, because Erica and Oliver were nice, geeky people and nobody felt embarrassed in front of nice, geeky people. That's why they were relaxing to be around. Maybe I'll meet you girls there, said her father. I have some errands to run after. Important errands, you know? No way, said her mother. Move it, move it. Jeez Louise. Her mum was putting her dad on a health kick. He had a giant, fat, hairy belly, but he could make his belly as hard as a rock if he wanted, and then he'd invite Dakota to punch him. Harder! He would roar like some sort of maniac. Are you a man or a mouse? What do you think, Dakota? Wouldn't you prefer to drive, huh? Much better. Much more comfortable, said her dad. We can stop and have ice cream after. I don't mind, said Dakota, as long as we're back by 3 o'clock. She was going to a Hunger Games party this afternoon, so none of this seemed that relevant. It was her friend Aisling's party, and Aisling's mother got really serious about themes. Presumably no one would actually die. She wouldn't go that far, but there would probably be some really cool archery or something. As they walked down their driveway toward the street, they heard someone call out from Harry's old house. Hey there! Barney, said Dakota's mum, as the dog nearly yanked her arm off, straining at the leash, jumping about excitedly and barking. If Dakota could translate dog language, she reckoned he would be saying, another human being. How great is this? Her dad stopped in his tracks. Hello! He shouted. Like, literally shouted. Like he was calling across a mountain range, not a front yard. How are you? Cracker of a day, isn't it? Her dad was as excited as Barney to see another human. Seriously. A man wearing a pale pink buttoned-up polo shirt and very bright white shorts came over towards them, carrying something in his arms. There was a big clean-up going on at Harry's house today. It had been strange to see pieces of furniture carried out. An old couch, a tiny television, an old, yellowing, stained mattress. Dakota had looked away. It was like seeing Harry's underwear. Hello, said the man, sounding breathless, as if he'd run over. He spoke to Dakota's mum. We met the other day, Steve. Steve Lunt.
Vid, pleased to meet you, said her dad.
We're off for a walk, you know? We're just walking straight out our front door. He made a karate chop motion with his hand. That's how we roll. We are outdoorsy people. Dakota squirmed. Hi, Steve, said her mum. How's the clean-up going? This is our daughter, Dakota, by the way, and our crazy dog, Barney. Dakota lifted her hand in the tiniest possible movement to make up for her dad's bigness and loudness. She tried not to make eye contact, so he didn't feel obliged to get all chatty and fake interested. What grade are you in at school? Hi, Dakota, said Steve. Actually, it's you I wanted to see. I wondered if you would like to have this old globe. Might look nice in your room. He held up an old-fashioned world globe on a wooden stand. It was a golden biscuity colour, and it had curly writing, like something from an old pirate treasure map. Dakota was surprised to find that she actually wanted it very badly. She could already see it sitting on her desk, glowing gold and mysterious. Well, that's really beautiful, said her mother, but it looks like an antique. It might be worth something. You might want to get it valued. No, I want you to have it. I want it to have a good home, said Steve. He smiled at Dakota with nice white teeth and handed the globe to her. Thank you, she said. It was heavier than she'd expected. Just don't rely on it to do your geography homework, he said. He touched it with his fingertip so that it spun gently. It shows Persia and Constantinople instead of Iran and Istanbul. It is very old indeed, then, said Vid. It's a very precious thing for you to give Dakota. Thank you. Persia. Constantinople. Dakota hugged the globe to her. I think it belonged to Harry's son, said Steve. He lowered his voice and turned his face slightly toward Dakota's mother, as if to avoid Dakota's hearing, although that just made Dakota listen more carefully. It looked like his son's bedroom hadn't been touched since the day he died. My mother thinks it was at least 50 years ago. It was the eeriest thing I've ever experienced. Like going back in time. There was a book. His voice got all wonky with emotion. Biggles learns to fly. Face down on the bed. All his clothes still in the wardrobe. Dakota's mother put her hand over her mouth. Oh, God, that poor, poor man. Great. Now her mother would feel even guiltier about horrible old spitty Harry. We took photos, said Steve solemnly. Dakota thought that was kind of inappropriate. Was he going to put the photos of the dead boy's room on Instagram now? Dakota's dad was getting restless. He rattled his house keys in his pocket. Let's put that beautiful globe safely inside, eh, Dakota? Thank you, said Dakota to Steve again. Thank you very, very much for this. You're very, very welcome, said Steve. I'm sure Harry would have been happy for you to have it. Old Harry was very fond of Dakota, said her dad. This was such a big, fat, total lie. Dakota could hardly believe it. He just maybe didn't always show it, you know? He looked at Steve. Mate, do you need a break? Do you want to come in for a coffee? Something to eat. We're going for a walk, Vid, interrupted her mother. Oh, yes, said her dad gloomily. I forgot for a moment. Chapter 83. The Day of the Barbecue. Harry climbed the stairs, hand over hand on the railing, like he was climbing up a rope. It was unacceptable that a man couldn't even climb his own stairs without his legs aching like they did. He'd once been as strong as an ox, and he'd always taken care of his health. He was interested in health. He kept himself up to date with things. As soon as the Surgeon General released the report about lung cancer and cigarettes, Harry gave up smoking. That same day. He knew about that food pyramid. He followed it as best he could. He did regular exercise. He took a multivitamin, as recommended by his GP, who looked like he was still in high school. And maybe he was still in high school, because the multivitamin was a waste of money. It had no effect whatsoever. Every day, he felt a bit worse. The manufacturers of that vitamin were laughing all the way to the bank. Harry was considering writing a letter of complaint. He averaged 2 to 3 letters of complaint a week. You had to keep corporate Australia accountable. When he was in the corporate world, there were standards. People cared about quality. The shoddy workmanship these days was a disgrace. He stopped halfway for a rest. This was why old codgers had to move out of their homes into those god-awful retirement places, because they couldn't make it up their own bloody stairs. What a joke. He wasn't moving anywhere. They could carry him out in a box. He could still hear the music from next door. Very selfish, bad-mannered people. He would call the police if necessary. He used to call the police all the time, when the son had those parties, while the parents went off on their bloody river cruises in the south of bloody France. The son with the long, greasy hair like a monkey. Disgusting creature. But those people weren't there anymore, were they? He knew that. Of course he knew that. They moved out about 10 years ago. He knew that perfectly well. He did a Sudoku puzzle every day. His mind was fine. It was just that he sometimes got fuzzy about time. It was the big Arab guy, or whatever nationality he was. Probably a terrorist. He couldn't tell these days. Harry had his mobile number. He had all his details carefully recorded, just in case he ever needed to pass them over to the police. He kept an eye on him. The wife had said they would turn down the music, but Harry strongly suspected they'd turned it up. What could you expect from a man who wore a bloody bracelet? The wife wasn't bad to look at, but she had no class. She dressed like a whore. That girl could have learned a thing or two about class, about elegance, from Harry's wife. Elizabeth would have set her straight. Their kid reminded Harry of Jamie. Something about the shape of her head. And something else. A kind of stillness, like a bird watcher, as if she were studying the world, carefully working it out. Jamie had been a thinker. It made Harry furious to look at that child. How dare she look like Jamie? How dare she be here when he wasn't? It enraged him. Sometimes when he looked at her, he literally saw red, like a fire glow. He kept climbing the stairs, one hand after the other on the railing. Harry used to run. He was a runner before running became trendy. This body used to run. He didn't recognize his own withered old legs anymore. Looked like they belonged to someone else. Why had no one invented a drug to stop this happening? It couldn't be that hard. It was because the researchers were all young and they didn't know what lay ahead. They were oblivious. They thought their bodies were theirs forever. And then by the time they found out, it was too late. They were retired and their minds were all fuzzy. Although Harry's mind wasn't fuzzy, he did Sudoku. "Don't run, don't run!" Elizabeth used to shout at Jamie when he ran along the bush tracks. She was worried he'd slip. But he never slipped. He was nimble. They used to walk out the back door with a packed picnic lunch and be at the waterfall within the hour. Now Harry was marooned in this house, like he was marooned in this body. He didn't even know if that walking track was still there, the track where Jamie used to run. He could find out, but if it was under a shopping centre, he'd be angry, and if it was still there, if other kids were running along it while their mothers shouted, "Don't run, don't run," he'd be angrier still. He was at the top. What a palaver to climb a flight of stairs. Now, why was he up here? What did he need? His mind wasn't going. Sometimes he couldn't find the right word for a thing, but he remembered that sometimes Elizabeth couldn't find a word. "Where's the thingamajig?" she'd say. And she'd been so young, so beautifully, gorgeously young. She had no idea how young she was. And he had no idea why he'd come upstairs. He could still hear the music from next door, even louder now. Who did they think they were, pretending to be artsy-fartsy types? Elizabeth used to love classical music. She played the violin at school. She had more class in her little finger than that little two-bit whore had in her whole body. She'd have shown her a thing or two. How dare they play it so loud? Inconsiderate! He imagined calling the police and telling them the neighbours were deafening him with bloody Mozart. Wasn't Mozart the deaf one? No wonder he wrote such crappy songs. Elizabeth used to laugh at his grumpiness. Elizabeth had a good sense of humour. So did Jamie. They both used to laugh at him. Once they were gone, nobody laughed at him ever again. All his funniness flew away with them. It was the neighbour's fault he couldn't remember why he was up here. He'd got distracted. He went into Jamie's room to calm himself and turned on the light. He looked out Jamie's window. The neighbours had all their outdoor lighting going. It was like bloody Disneyland down there. There were two little girls running about. One of them had wings on her back, like a tiny fairy. The other one was wearing an old-fashioned-looking little pink coat. Elizabeth would have liked that pink coat. He could see the bloody dog zipping back and forth, yip-yap-yapping. It had been digging up Harry's garden today, as happy as you please. Harry had given it a kick up the backside to show it what's what. It wasn't a hard kick, but it was true that both Elizabeth and Jamie wouldn't have laughed at that. They would have stopped speaking to him, probably. He and Elizabeth had been going to give Jamie a dog for his 9th birthday. They should have done it for his 8th. He looked out the window. The electricity bill for all those tiny lights must be exorbitant. He could see the people from two doors down. Oliver. Namby-pamby name, but he was a nice enough bloke. He could have a sensible conversation with him. Although he rode a bike and wore those shiny, tight black shorts. Looked like a bloody galah when he did that. He couldn't remember his wife's name, one of those worried, skinny women. No kids. Maybe they didn't want them. Maybe they couldn't have them. The wife didn't have good childbearing hips, that's for sure. Although now they could mix them up in test tubes. Elizabeth would have liked a little sister for Jamie. She always looked at little girls. She liked their dresses. "Look at that little girl's pretty dress," she'd say to him, as if Harry ever gave two hoots about a little girl's pretty dress. She was looking at a little girl that day, a little girl clutching a stick with a giant ball of fluffy pink fairy floss. Elizabeth said, "Look at that. It's nearly as big as her." But Harry had just grunted in response because he was in a bad mood. He wanted to leave. It was a Sunday afternoon and they had a long drive back and he was thinking about work and the week ahead. The union was giving them grief. Harry didn't like Sunday nights to feel rushed. He liked to feel sorted for the week. He hadn't wanted to drive all the way out to bumfuck nowhere to come to this crummy little country fair. He shouldn't have said bumfuck nowhere to Elizabeth because she hated that. It really offended her. He was just thinking about the union rep, a tough bugger that one, and the battle ahead. The union rep came to the funeral. He hugged Harry, and Harry didn't want to be hugged. But he didn't want to be at his wife's funeral either. He should have been nicer to Elizabeth and Jamie that day. He would have been nicer if he'd known it was the last day they'd ever have together. He wouldn't have said bumfuck nowhere. He wouldn't have told Jamie that the games were all rigged and he was never going to win. He wouldn't have grunted when Elizabeth pointed out the little girl with the fairy floss. But then again, he should have been grumpier. He should have been firmer. He should have said no when they wanted to go on that ride for the third time. He did say no, but Elizabeth didn't take any notice. She grabbed Jamie's hand and said, "Just one more turn." And off they ran. If he saw them again, he would shout at them. He would shout, "I said no. I was the man of the house." Then he would hold them both in his arms and never, ever let them go. If he saw them again. Elizabeth believed in the hereafter, and Harry hoped she was right. She was right about most things. Except that day, she hadn't been right. It was called the spider. It had eight long legs with a car at the end of each leg for up to eight people. The legs went up and down, and then the whole thing spun around in a circle. Each time they'd flown by, he'd seen a brief glimpse of their pink, laughing faces, their heads flung back against the seats. It had made him feel sick. The spider had been built 10 years earlier by an Australian manufacturer with a German name, Flugzeug Amusement Rides. Flugzeug Amusement Rides had provided only rudimentary maintenance and inspection procedures for the spider. The company that ran the fun fair was called Sullivan and Sons. Sullivan and Sons was in deep financial shit. They made staff cuts. A dedicated maintenance manager, called Primo Paspas, was let go. Primo had set out his own maintenance schedule for all the rides in a red notebook. The red notebook disappeared when he lost his job. Primo thumped his fist against his knee when he testified in court. He had bright tears in his eyes. One of the mechanical bearings malfunctioned on the spider, and a car spun free. All eight laughing, screaming passengers died. 5 adults and 3 children. The court cases dragged on for years. It consumed Harry. He still had the files, big foolscap binders filled with a story of negligence and incompetence and idiocy. Nobody ever stood up and took responsibility. Only Primo Paspaz said, "I'm sorry," to Harry. He said, "It would never have happened on my watch." People needed to take responsibility. Harry turned away from the window and spun Jamie's globe so that all the places Jamie never got to see sped by his finger. He looked back out the window at the neighbours. It occurred to him that if Elizabeth had lived, he would have been down there at that barbecue, because Elizabeth was so sociable and the Arab was always inviting Harry over, as if he really wanted him to come. It was peculiar. For a moment, Harry could see it so clearly, the way this night was meant to be. Elizabeth sitting at the table enjoying the music. Harry pretending to be grumpy about it, and everyone laughing because Elizabeth made his grumpiness funny. Harry watched the two little girls run about the yard. It seemed to be a game of chasing. The littler one got herself up onto the side of the fountain. She was carrying a little blue handbag. She ran around the edge. The fountain was the size of a swimming pool. "Careful there, little girl," said Harry out loud to her. "You could fall in." Was anyone even watching her? He scanned the backyard. The other adults were all gathered around the table, not even looking at the kids. They were laughing their heads off. He couldn't hear their laughter over the music. He couldn't see Oliver, but he could see his wife, Erica, that was her name, standing on the pathway that led from the back door. She'd be able to see the little girl. He looked back at the fountain, and his heart dropped. The little girl was gone. Had she climbed down off the wall? Then he saw it, the pink coat. Christ almighty, she was face down. She'd fallen in. It was like he'd made it happen by predicting it. He looked for an adult. Where was that Erica? She must have seen it. She was standing right there with a direct line of vision. But she was just standing there. What was the stupid woman doing? She's fallen in. He banged his hands on the glass. Oliver's wife didn't move. She just stood there, like a statue. Her face turned away as if she didn't want to see, as if she was deliberately looking the other way. For God's sake, what was wrong with her? What was wrong with all these stupid people? My God, my God, my God! Harry's face was hot with rage. The little girl was drowning right there in front of those idiotic, irresponsible people. Shooting was too good for them. He tried to pull up the window so he could yell out, but it was jammed closed. It hadn't been opened in years. He banged so hard with both fists on the glass, it hurt. He yelled, louder than he'd yelled in years. "She's drowning!" Finally, the woman looked up at him, Oliver's wife. Their eyes met. "Thank God, thank God! She's drowning!" screamed Harry. He jabbed his finger at the fountain. "The little girl is drowning!" He watched her turn her head toward the fountain. Slowly, as if there were no great hurry. And still she didn't move. The stupid, idiotic woman didn't move. She just stood there, looking at the fountain. It was like something from a nightmare. Harry heard himself sob with frustration. Time was running out. He turned from the window and ran from the room. It was the only way. He had to be fast. He had to be nimble. He had to run next door and pull the little girl out himself.